And now on WRS, Michael McKay with the McKay Interview.
Hello, everyone. My guest today is Professor Julian Lindley French. He's an expert analyst with a focus on the tension between strategy and politics and an emphasis on security and defence policy. He lives in the Netherlands, where he is chairman of the Alphen Group, and visits Geneva from time to time, where he lectures at the Geneva Centre for Security Policy. Among many other things, he's a fellow of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, senior fellow at the Institute for Strategic Statecraft in London, distinguished visiting research fellow at the National Defence University, Washington, D.C., and former vice president of the Atlantic Treaty Association. He's been on the McKay Interview a couple of times before over the past 10 to 12 years, and I've taken the opportunity, as he's here for a few days, to get his views on the big security issues and some very particular issues that occupy the headlines these days. Welcome back to Geneva, Julian. It's good to see you again.
Michael, lovely to see you, and thank you for the invitation.
Julian, hard to believe, 2014, Obama was in the White House, Hollande was in the Elysee Palace, Cameron was in 10 Downing Street, and Merkel was in the Chancellery in Berlin. 2018, the last time we saw each other, the democracies had changed. Trump is in the White House, Macron in the Elysee Palace, May in 10 Downing Street, Merkel was still in the Chancellery in Berlin. And today, well, we know the situation. Biden faces Trump in November, and the election seems to be that it could go either way. Macron is in the Elysee Palace. Sunak is at 10 Downing Street and faces an election, likely defeat later this year. And Olaf Scholz is in Berlin. The constant faces of Xi and Vladimir Putin, who won yet another election very recently, have been around since we met 10 years ago and longer, and who knows how they will end up. You said to me, Julian, in 2014, and I quote your words, "The world is a safer place when the West is strong. We are at an inflection point." 2014. Julian, is the world a safer place, and is the West strong?
No. It was an inflection point, and it's an inflection point to which we have responded poorly. We are not as strong as we should be. Our leaders do not understand the importance of defence in particular as the hard core of influence.
Our leaders being our political leaders.
Whereas the likes of President Xi and President Putin do. That's their, if you like, their very method of power. It's hard power. We've been set back in places like Afghanistan, Iraq, and a host of other places, including the Sahel, where we'll discuss later. In a sense, Europeans have lost strategic confidence, and American leadership is nothing like as assured as it used to be. So we are again at an inflection point, with so many important elections taking place in the United States this year, in the UK this year, European elections. It is the nature of democracy.
India, I believe,
in India as well.
Yes,
and you know, it's the nature of democracies, Michael, to change. It is the nature of autocracies not to. To hang on to power as long as the individuals in charge can. And that is the essential struggle that we're now seeing in geopolitics the world over.
So let's just begin our conversation with that very strong phrase, just to, as an opening statement, look at Russia and what was the former USSR. With the benefit of hindsight, Julian, this is a wonderful thing, and we can treat ourselves to all kinds of special situations and insights. With the benefit of hindsight, did the West play its good hand badly after the dissolution of the USSR in 1991, there seemed to be so much promise at the time of Gorbachev and even Yeltsin, yet Russia has ended up with a dictator who detains, who arrests and even kills his opponents, whether inside or outside Russia. And I'm not saying that Russia isn't responsible for its own destiny, but what did the West do wrong?
Nothing.
Nothing.
We did not lose Russia. There's a narrative that's very popular in certain bien-pensant circles.
I'm repeating it, yes.
Yeah, that somehow the West lost Russia. No, the KGB state.
That's the strongest state. I'm not quite saying that, but I'm just wondering if we could have done things a bit differently, the West.
Hard to see what the difference could have been or the difference we could have made given the nature of the Russian elite. Russians view the world in a very different way. What you've seen in the last 30 years is the KGB state, the old KGB state, which Putin is the leader of, regaining power. The chaos of the Yeltsin years. Well, what were we meant to do? Were we meant to basically pay for Russians in the wake of the end of the Cold War? No. Were we meant to deny free countries, newly freed countries like Poland, like the Baltic states, like Romania, like Bulgaria, who'd fought for their freedom? Were we to deny them the right to choose their alliances? Of course not. That is a fundamental principle of freedom. Russia had a choice to make. Did it begin the long road, difficult road, to becoming some kind of parliamentary democracy, not the what I call the democracy that we've seen in the last few days?
Yes.
With President Putin's re-election.
Yes.
Or did it go back to old habits, Stalinist habits? And sadly, it's chosen the latter. And I've looked at this, I've considered this at great length and in great depth. I find it hard to see where exactly we lost Russia. I think Russia lost Russia. And the greatest tragedy is not just for the poor Ukrainian people, but for Russians themselves.
Yes, I see that. Now, a slightly different question, where we're just going to step outside a little bit of what I've just said. Now, the opposite of what Putin's Kremlin, well, I'll be quite specific, don't take the Russian people, because they probably don't have much of a say in it, but let's say Putin's Kremlin wants, i.e. a stronger NATO on its western borders, has materialised. I'm referring to Finland, obviously, and Sweden's accession into NATO. But for non-military listeners like me, please explain the strategic significance of the military power of those two new member countries.
Well, first of all, they make the NATO space far more coherent in military terms. Look at a map.
Now, when you use a word like coherent, what do you actually mean by that? Just strip it away a little bit for me.
It's now a single block. The so-called area of responsibility of General Chris Cavioli, who's the Supreme Allied Commander, the NATO military boss, is now much easier to defend. It's now one block from the Arctic to the Mediterranean,
yes,
including the Nordic countries, the Baltic countries. Finland and Sweden both have what's called a total defence concept.
Mm-hmm.
They can bring very considerable means. And the Russians know full well that having those two countries inside NATO strengthens the alliance quite considerably.
I'm sorry for this ignorant question, but do they have conscription in those countries or professional armies?
They have what they call volunteer conscripts.
Yeah.
And they're re-looking at the issue of conscription in Sweden in particular.
Yeah.
I'm there next week talking to the Swedes. Because they are going back to this total defence concept. But they're very good at what they do. The Finns have a very powerful army.
And, of course, they have the experience.
And they've been there before. In fact, if looking at it from a Russian perspective, it's the axis between Moscow, St. Petersburg, and their northern fleet base in Murmansk that, from a Russian perspective, would now look particularly vulnerable. Kaliningrad.
And geographically, where is Murmansk? I don't have a good picture of that.
Yeah, imagine the very north of Russia.
Right.
That's the home of the Russian northern fleet on the Kola Peninsula. And that fleet is their most powerful fleet.
So it's iced in then for a large part of the year?
No, it's not. It's actually a deep water port that they can use. It was where the convoys during World War II went to, because it was a ice-free deep water port.
I see. I didn't know that.
So it's a very important strategic asset for the Russians. From their perspective, they clearly feel that they're more vulnerable. But there's a bigger geopolitical game going on with this. If you've noticed, Putin has been aggressive at some level in responding to Finland and Sweden joining NATO. Cyber attacks, hybrid warfare attacks. But probably less than some people imagine, partly because he's busy in Ukraine. But Finland and Sweden have been EU member states for a long time. Because of that, in Putin's very traditional realpolitik balance of power mind, the Finns and the Swedes have always been part of the Western camp. But he implies, by if not accepting it, being less aggressive than he might have been, a quid pro quo, that implicitly we accept that the Donbass and Crimea in Ukraine are indeed parts of Russia.
I see.
Because
I see.
They're part of Novorossiya, Russia, yeah. Putin's dream of rebuilding what was the old 17th and 18th century Russian Empire. And because they're Russian-speaking, they're part of the diaspora. So he's looking for some kind of trade-off. And I think that the phrase that's going to be prevalent in the coming years, particularly if President Trump has a second term, will be trade-offs. There'll be a lot of those.
Transactional stuff.
Transactional, yeah. Foreign policy.
Which is Trump's
forte.
He says, even despite his bankruptcies.
Well, that's true, but he sees geopolitics as business. I disagree with him, but that's how he sees geopolitics. And many in the West will argue that Ukraine's great success will be to survive as a coherent state, even if it loses parts of Donbass and Crimea, which on paper should not happen. But European history is full of fudged deals.
Yes, yes.
And that's where this war is going.
Okay, well, you've brought me round to my next question. We move south to the war between Russia and Ukraine. How will it end, I want to ask you? I know you don't have a crystal ball, but if anybody has a good sense of scenarios, you do, on these things. You once said to me, and I hate to keep quoting these words back, your words back to you, Julian, that we must keep talking to Russia. How can the West do that when Putin's Russia seems to do nothing but destroy, lay waste towns, cities, and civilians, not forgetting their own young soldiers? How do you keep talking to them?
What do we want them to understand? What we want the regime to understand, and I've studied the regime, these are the people around Putin, not just Putin himself. The message we wish to convey is, okay, you've launched this disastrous invasion of Ukraine, but if you have ambitions to go any further, such as the Baltic states, don't even think about it. Now, that is happening through back channels as we speak.
What is it?
That conversation. Yeah. Europeans have increased their defence budgets markedly in the last 4 or 5 years. The 2% GDP baseline, which was set back in 2014 for NATO countries to spend on defence, is now the baseline. The Americans...
Across
most of the member nations. So there's been a marked increase. We have responded. Given that, the message is clear. But ultimately, we're trying to avoid nuclear war.
And one
has to maintain a dialogue, even with your enemies.
Yes.
Most definitely with your enemies.
I see that, but I just wasn't sure if that was going on.
Oh, it is going on. Yeah. Many back-channel conversations are taking place. Because they have to, because the stakes are simply too high. The tragedy of Ukraine and the next 3 or 4 months, particularly the next 2 months, as the spring season, as the mud dries out and the campaign season in eastern Ukraine restarts, we're likely to see some kind of Russian offensive, although I find it very hard to see what they could bring to the field that could make a decisive breakthrough.
Because the intelligence of what they have tells you that they don't have that much left in their arsenal.
They're rebuilding their armed forces.
Yeah.
And they are modernising their air force. Their air force is now playing a much stronger role, having been effectively reorganised in the last 2 years. That's partly why it hasn't been seen very much. They still have a powerful air force they could deploy. The Russian army has learnt lessons. The Russian general staff are very good at learning lessons, like the old Stavka. Yeah. In World War II. The Ukrainians are not being given enough of the ammunition they've been promised.
That's clear.
That's beginning to kind of ease.
Yeah.
The danger is we've given the Ukrainians just enough to stay in the fight, but not enough to prevail. And the Russians have strategic depth in as much as they can keep this war going indefinitely.
Yeah. Well, that's my next question, Julian. Has it not been dishonest and disingenuous of certain Western powers, mainly America and Germany, and our mutual friend, General David Richards, said this quite explicitly when we spoke a few months ago, in claiming full support for Ukraine and its efforts to protect its sovereign borders against the invading Russians, but not actually following through and keeping its promises in a timely manner regarding material?
Yes.
Yes.
Partly because we didn't have the productive capacity to do that. We've emaciated, particularly European defence industries. I've been arguing against it for decades.
I remember, we talked about this before.
And now the chickens, as they were, are coming home to roost. People who told me I was wrong suddenly claim they knew all along that this was going to happen. They didn't. They made terrible mistakes in undermining our armed forces, undermining our defence industrial base. So our ability to suddenly increase production of critical ammunition, particularly 155mm artillery shells, is very limited. It's beginning to happen, but it will take time to ramp up. Now, the result is that the Ukrainians are suffering as a result. The other problem is that many of the inventories of Western European militaries have been emptied to support the Ukrainians. They're going to have to be replaced. So you have almost like a panicked reaction to the failed politics of the period 2000-2022 by a political class in Europe that simply did not get geopolitics, did not understand it.
So they made promises to people that would affect people's lives based on essentially notions of availability which weren't borne out by the facts of the machines that make these things.
There has been no relationship for a long time, Michael, between the claims our political leaders have made about their commitment to security and defence of Europe and their capacity to do it. I got myself in trouble recently by pointing out that every time the British government increases its defence budget, the British Army gets smaller. And there's a danger that the British government increases the defence budget too much, the British Army will cease to exist.
Yeah.
It's this kind of nonsense.
It's not funny, really.
It's not funny.
No.
But it's this kind of nonsense. And I'll be chairing a meeting next week with senior commanders to discuss this.
Mm.
What do we do about this? The simple truth is that too many Western European politicians in particular, and it's Western Europeans, not Central or Eastern Europeans, they understand the realities of
life. And
you
include the Americans in that, do you?
The Americans, to a significant extent, yeah, but they're separate.
Mindset's different.
They're different. Yeah. They've always had a higher commitment to defence.
Yeah.
They have a global footprint, therefore they have to have a global view,
yes,
which, given the rise of China, means that they recognise the need for military power. The three major Western European powers are the ones that have really caused this crisis in European security: Britain, France and Germany, because they created in the mind of President Putin the belief he could get away with invading another European country in the 21st century.
Mm.
That's the critical error we've made, much like we did in the 1930s with Hitler.
That's a good point to change direction of our conversation, Julian. But my guest today is Professor Julian Lindley French, chairman of the Alphen Group in the Netherlands, lecturing for a day or two here in Geneva at the Geneva Centre for Security Policy. And we're in Geneva, not so far away from the GCSP as we speak. Julian, Gaza, Israel. When we last spoke, and again I quote your words back at me, you used the expression locked in stasis. Well, that stasis was blown apart last October. As a military strategist, please give me your assessment of the conflict. Has Benjamin Netanyahu got himself and Israel into a box of his own making? And did he have any other options after the massacre of the 7th of October?
I don't believe he had any other options but to attack Hamas after what happened, the appalling atrocity of 7th of October. But at the same time, and I have to be clear about this, I'm a believer in Israel's right to exist, but I don't believe in Israel's right to do anything. And frankly, I wrote a piece immediately after the 7th of October attack in which I advised, hoped that Israel would not do what its enemies wanted it to do. And it's done exactly that.
So let me press you then. How does a state fight a terrorist organization, a sovereign state versus the terrorist organization, namely in this case Hamas, sworn publicly over and over again to destroy it, to deny its very existence? What to do, Julian?
What Israel is doing at one level, which is to fight them across diplomatic, information, military and economic lines of attack. The most important aspect of Israel's foreign policy of late are the Abraham Accords.
Tell us a bit, for those of us who don't follow it so closely, just give us a bit more information on that.
Certain Arab states in the Gulf have recognized Israel, Bahrain, right. Most notably. There's the possibility that Saudi Arabia would also recognize Israel.
They were moving closer together.
They're moving closer together, and partly because of a fear of Iran. The mutual fear of Iran. Iran wanted to destroy that, and the Hamas attack and the whilst the Iranians, there's no evidence the Iranians had direct involvement in that. Clearly, the attack helped the Iranian cause by making it harder for the Saudis to recognize Israel, given Israel's response. So, the specific problem is that we still have a political stasis in the Levant, in the area where Gaza, the West Bank, and Israel, Jordan exists, Syria. But it's now a violent stasis. And until there are people who can negotiate, and I still believe, for all the criticism in a two-state solution, in which Israelis treat a Palestinian state with respect, they observe the agreements, particularly when it comes to illegal settlements in the West Bank, and in return there is a growing recognition across the entire Arab world that Israel is a presence in the Middle East and will remain so, and that can only become if men and women of good faith can negotiate. What's happening at the moment is that the violence, the tragedy, the death, the killing that we're seeing is simply creating fertile ground for extremists to hold on to power. And for them, simply holding on to power is the object, not a political settlement which would see the well-being of Arabs and Israelis across the region greatly enhanced.
So how does the fight end? I mean, there's obviously talks, demonstrations in many countries around the world. We had a big one here in Geneva just at the weekend of a ceasefire.
Yeah, these protests are irrelevant.
Are irrelevant.
They're irrelevant.
Yeah.
They have no bearing on those responsible for a peace. Those responsible for a peace are Hamas commanders mainly sitting in the Gulf states, particularly Qatar. And the Israeli government.
Yeah.
Now, ultimately, that's where the peace deal is going to emerge, brokered by these various Gulf states, allies of Israel, working with both sides. But what we're likely to get, even if there was some kind of ceasefire, is simply a pause in an iterative struggle, because the underlying political reality, which is that many Palestinians, massive bulk of Palestinians, do not recognize the state of Israel and do not feel that Israel treats them equitably. And many Israelis feel that they are threatened on what they regard as their holy land. That is the essential equation that we have to address. And like so much in contemporary politics and strategy, our leaders talk around subjects, but they don't talk to the subject, and it is going to require genuine statecraft and leadership, mainly from the United States, as ever, because Europeans are divided and weak, to play that brokering role, which will be vital, at least to stop the killing, which we all lament. It's simply dreadful.
It's such a complicated topic that I really would like to spend more time on it, but I just there are some other parts of the world that I want to talk about before we finish our conversation. But maybe on another occasion we could come back to the fundamental of what you said, which is the building trust, because that takes time, and particularly when you've had so many tens of thousands of people who've been killed, the hostages, and there are still some left, and we just hope to God the ones that are still there are released.
Indeed.
That I just don't see how human nature can cope with that. We just seem to be stretched to the very limit on that. But I don't want to end on a negative, but it is a real problem, and I don't pretend to have an answer. Let's just move to the South China Sea, hard to say quickly. Your assessment, Julian, of this source of tension between China and Taiwan, containment, stasis? The USA, as I understand it, is not treaty-bound to rescue Taiwan, yet Biden has made such encouraging noises. Is the USA misleading the Taiwanese? What happens over there? Is China just tugging the lion's tail and testing the United States?
Well, it's a paradox. The Americans do not have the legal position to defend Taiwan because they've accepted legally that Taiwan is indeed part of China. But the Chinese do not have the military capacity to undertake a major maritime amphibious invasion of a well-defended Taiwan.
Even with the arms that they've been building over
time? Even with the arms that they've been building. Look, the distance between mainland China and Taiwan, the shortest distance, is almost exactly the distance between Portsmouth and the Normandy beaches. Mm.
I've been there.
You've seen what the distance is. When we carried out D-Day in 1944, June 1944, the Anglo-Americans, the world's two primary blue water military powers, big naval powers, we'd already had several major landings to test all this. Sicily, Salerno, Anzio, we'd been learning how to do this. The Chinese have no naval tradition to speak of. No so-called
land wars with their neighbours.
They haven't had those kind of wars.
Going westward.
Correct.
Yeah.
And they have no amphibious experience. Combined operations of the sort we launched on D-Day are incredibly complicated and can go horribly wrong. And they'll be facing Taiwanese missile attacks. In fact, the Chinese would probably launch a massive missile barrage ahead of an attempted invasion. But even with the PLA and the PLAN, the People's Liberation Army and the People's Liberation Army Navy, the risk of a Chinese military disaster trying to invade Taiwan is enormous. And also the possibility of drawing in Japan, which is becoming increasingly important military power. So if I'm sitting in Beijing and I'm President Xi, I've said I want to reunify China by 2049 and the centenary of the founding of the success of Mao and the founding of the communist state, but I'd much prefer to do it in a peaceful manner than risk the kind of military adventurism that would have to be risked through an invasion of Taiwan by the Chinese.
Oh, I see what you mean. Look, I'm going to move on quickly, unfairly really, but because time is against us, but we can't have a conversation about strategic security without talking about the African continent. We have the Sahel and Sudan, thousands dying. I checked before we had this conversation, around 9,000 dead in the Sahel, around 15,000 dead in Sudan. But it doesn't seem to appear on the newspapers, front pages of Western press. Do heavyweight military strategists like you pay any attention to what's going on there, especially now that the French have reduced their military presence? Is it important?
It's hugely important.
Well, tell me a bit more about why it doesn't seem to get the attention.
To Europeans, because much of our migration, mass migration, which is a structural shift in human behaviour, which we see every now and then in history. Mm. We get these massive migrations. Of mainly young men. It happens in history. Mm. They're driven by these kind of conflicts. But the reality, Michael, is we haven't got a clue. We don't know what to do. We didn't know what to do in Iraq. We didn't know what to do in Afghanistan. And we are now so risk-averse of getting sucked into places like the Sahel, where if you are going to engage in huge regions like this, these are huge regions, you've got to stay there for a very, very long time.
Which the French had, in a way, but for different motivations.
Yeah, for different motivations, yeah. And they failed.
Yeah,
I mean, make no mistake, the French failed in Mali. And they tried to get the rest of us involved, but we were all very careful because of Libya, because of everything that we've touched has turned bad. So politics being politics, when you haven't got a possible solution, you pretend there isn't a problem, but there is. And we really should be paying much more attention to the suffering of people who really are our neighbours.
And did migration, I guess you were at the Munich conference recently, did migration feature in the debate or was it just in the corridors?
I wasn't this year at you the Munich there. Conference, okay. As I understand it, not much. Forward, about how we make complex societies work, how we make them secure, and how communities live together. Because those who wallow in nostalgia about societies which no longer exist, well, I'm sorry. Change happens, and the sole political objective must be to make our societies of today and tomorrow work, not wallow in some strange nostalgia about good old days 60, 70, 80 years ago.
Julian, my last question is unfair. I hope it's not just a yes or no answer, but I have to ask back to NATO. Is it conceivable that the United States of America could withdraw from NATO like President de Gaulle did with France in 1966?
No. And the reason not, in the same way that France didn't really withdraw from NATO.
Well, it was a nuanced question, but tell me a bit more about what withdrawal in the French case was under de Gaulle.
The French withdrew from the military integrated military command structure.
Right.
But they didn't withdraw from the political structure of the alliance. They maintained full membership of that, which meant that they effectively were part of the decision-making group, even if they were not part of the military command structure.
So de Gaulle was still at the table?
They were still at the table, precisely. As the Americans become increasingly overstretched by the rise of China, by the challenge of Russia, by other domestic issues that they have to face, they need their allies more, not less. Now, they have a right to expect that their allies are capable allies, and we're beginning to move in that direction. They need allies in the Indo-Pacific, like Australia, Japan. I call it Team Freedom, if you like, and in Europe. So the Americans might express frustrations with their allies, but they're not going to withdraw from NATO. Why? Because it's the most advanced multinational mechanism for democracies to use military power legitimately in the 21st century world. There is nothing like it. It's the devil's in the detail with NATO. And for the Americans to give up that would be shooting themselves in the foot in a most calamitous way. So let's put aside some of the rhetoric that we hear out of the US. Europeans have to share more of the burdens. For example, 50% of all the capabilities that NATO needs should be European by 2030.
What are they now, just to give us a sense of comparison?
About
30%, okay.
In some areas, I have to say what they call enablers, without getting too technical. These are things like heavy lift aircraft and missile defences. It's sometimes as high as 90% the Americans provide. We've got to do far better on that, and we're beginning to do far better on that. But the Americans also face a paradox, which I say to them, my American friends, very bluntly, which is, you want Europeans to do more in NATO, but you want to exert the same level of control. But the more that Europeans can do,
the more they want to say.
The more say they will want, and the less control you will have.
Yeah.
Beware of what you wish for,
Washington.
And they're beginning to grapple with that reality.
Julian, thank you for the sobering clarity. That's always the case with you. It's refreshing to listen to you, but at the same time, the sobering clarity brings me up with a jolt, and I'm sure many of the listeners will feel the same way. My guest today has been Professor Julian Lindley French, chairman of the Alphen Group in the Netherlands, and today visiting to lecture at the Geneva Centre for Security Policy. Thanks again, Julian.
Thank you, Michael.
That was the McKay Interview with Michael McKay. And don't forget, you can hear that interview again on our website, worldradio.ch.